Welcome to Profiles. I'm Moya Andrews, and today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who in this past year has come to play a very important role in our local community. He is Malcolm Abrams, editor and publisher of Bloom Magazine. Welcome, Malcolm.
Thank you, Moya.
Many of our listeners know about your magazine, but some may not yet be familiar with it. So can you tell us a bit about Bloom?
Well, it's a city magazine. It's a culture and lifestyle magazine. It's published 6 times a year. It's a free magazine. It's available at 160 businesses in Bloomington. It is all about Bloomington. There's nothing that comes from wire services or is written by stories that we're picking up from other places. Everything is about Bloomington and the Bloomington environment.
So the residents and visitors to Bloomington are your target audience, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. We're in about a dozen of the hotels, and visitors also get the magazine because they're shopping and going to restaurants, and we're available in all of those places.
Well, this makes us a little bit like a big city to have our own magazine. How do you pay for a venture like this?
Well, all of the money comes from advertising. In fact, most magazines, all of their revenue comes from advertising. Very few magazines make anything from subscriptions or newsstand sales.
So what's involved in starting a magazine? How do you start something like this from scratch?
You know, I came to Bloomington for a visit in May of 2005. I was here for 4 days. And I absolutely fell in love with Bloomington. But even looking back on that, I had no idea really how wonderful Bloomington was. But I fell in love with it because I thought there were beautiful neighborhoods. There was an opera house. There was Big Ten sports. I knew about the music school, so I knew there would be a lot of entertainment, good climate. I just thought it was the ideal small city. I went back to New York, and this was just – I was just starting really to – in the last couple of years after living in New York for 30 years, I was just starting to think that I wanted to live someplace else. I had had a long love affair with New York. I lived in Greenwich Village. I had a wonderful life. But New York was changing. I was changing. Village was getting younger. I was getting older. And I started to think about moving. And I went back to New York and I really started thinking about moving to Indiana. And my friends, you know, could not believe this. I was such a quintessential New Yorker. But I didn't know what I would do if I moved to Bloomington. I didn't want to retire. And then I was really just walking down 6th Avenue one day, and I thought, hey, I've been in the magazine business for 30 years. I could start a magazine there. I hadn't seen one on my visit. So I sort of divided it up into stages. I'm giving you the real long answer.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. This is very interesting.
So I divided it up into stages, and the first stage was really to do research. And I spent a couple of months researching Bloomington. I subscribed online to the HT. I went to all of the sites about Bloomington on the web. I went to the sites of businesses in Bloomington. It's just amazing how deep you can go. Then I also started investigating city and regional magazines, and I looked at about 75 of them to see what kind of editorial they ran, how they were staffed, what kind of advertising they got. So I did an investigation of that, and it became apparent that this was a really bad idea because there were no communities the size of Bloomington that really had a significant city magazine.
So it was too small.
It was too small. The only communities would be communities like Greenwich, Connecticut, where the household income is $775,000, which is, you know, about $725,000 higher than Bloomington.
Mm.
And maybe the occasional city that was primarily a tourist destination. Those were the only ones that had city magazines. But so this really wasn't a good idea.
So you weren't deterred, though?
No, I wasn't deterred. There were 3 questions, really, and 2 of them were obvious to me. 1, there would be plenty to write about. 2, I assumed because of the university and the arts community here that there would be talented people that I could get to work for the magazine. The big question was, would the business community support a city magazine? So I guess I'm a bit of a gambler. Matter of fact, I know I'm a bit of a gambler. So I sold my co-op apartment in New York City. And – oh, I did sort of a business plan. I didn't – because I wasn't – I didn't need investors for this. I didn't really do a full business plan. But what I did was a four-year financial projection, which, you know, looking back is totally ridiculous. I actually sort of knew it was ridiculous at the time. I'd only been to Bloomington for 4 days and I'm calculating what it will cost and how much advertising I'm going to sell. But I went through the exercise and it gave me a rough idea, I think, of what I needed to do. And so I sold my co-op apartment. I had a house in the country. I kept that just in case. And I drove the 14 hours to Bloomington. I knew two people here and not well. I knew them. I'd only known them for a few days. And I and a real estate agent. And she put me up in a student apartment at the corner of Lincoln and 10th, which always gets a big laugh when I mention this to people. And it was a truly horrible student apartment. And the floors curved and there were holes in the windows. I had to dig my feet in underneath my desk or my chair would roll away. And I started doing the magazine. The next stage was to sell advertising. I was very fortunate. I came across a fellow named Matt Martin who had managed a rock band called Murder by Death. And he had about 8 or 9 weeks before they were going on tour, or he was going on tour with them. And he'd worked at the Chamber of Commerce. I put together materials, sales materials, a media kit. Met Matt, and we went through the Chamber of Commerce directory, and he sort of checked off everybody he knew, and then we went out and started selling advertising.
So you made cold calls.
He made the cold calls. Which was great because, you know, when you're sort of living in a student apartment and you have this idea for a magazine, you might not have as much confidence, you know, from phoning from that environment. So it was good to have somebody who knew the people phone, and we got a lot of appointments. I gave myself 2 months, February and March, to sell half the amount of advertising I thought I would need for the first issue. And if I hadn't sold that advertising, then I would have terminated the magazine. As it turned out, we sold it in 5 weeks, half of what we thought we'd need. The business community was extremely receptive. Many people said, we've been waiting for something like this. There really hasn't been any place to advertise our, what we do or what we sell. It certainly exceeded my expectations. I can remember going on one sale where we just put the media kit down on the table and I started doing my spiel and the woman said, you don't have to say anymore. You've sold me just on the name. So in those first few months, I was selling and I was also starting to find the writers and the photographers and the design people and the production people and the printer and all of those things that you need to do a magazine.
And how many staff did you assemble before the first issue came out?
Zero. There was no staff.
So it was just you?
Yeah, and a lot of freelancers.
Ah.
After Matt went off to with Murder by Death, I was very fortunate to meet a woman named Pat Bailey who has a business here called Social Butterfly Event and Wedding Planning. And she had also worked at the Chamber of Commerce. So we went through the list again and she checked off everybody she knew and we went off to sell them advertising. So Pat works for me part-time. About 2 months ago, I brought on another part-time person, an editorial person named Ron Eid, who was an experienced journalist.
So it's not quite a one-man band.
No, it's one and two large halves.
My goodness. There must be a lot of different hats that you wear, Malcolm. How does this magazine compare with other magazines in this region and in the state of Indiana? Is there anything like it nearby?
I don't think there's anything like it because I don't think there's another community that's like Bloomington. I think Bloomington is really special. I think a lot of that has – certainly a lot of it has to do with the university and the music department in particular. But there is a, you know, really thriving arts community here separate from the university as well. They may have been attracted by the university or they may have gone here and stayed, but it really is separate from the university. Mm. You know, I think that Bloomington – it's an overused word, but I think Bloomington is a unique community. And the magazine in its attempt to reflect what that community is very different. I looked at the Evansville magazine when I was still in New York at what they were doing, and they have a fairly successful operation there. It's, of course, it's a larger community, but a very different community. I know West Lafayette has just started a magazine, but they're all very, very different from Bloom.
Mm. What other factors besides the characteristics of the community affect the success rate of a magazine? What kinds of things? Is there a critical population? You said that our population wasn't quite as high as you would have thought would be helpful for a successful magazine.
Well, I think the population is really important because it's not only how many readers you're going to have, but it's also how many businesses are going to be there. I think Bloomington has about 2,000 businesses. And, you know, certainly many of those businesses are not the kind of businesses that would be advertising in Bloom or would be able to advertise in Bloom. So, you know, I thought I was looking at a fairly small universe. So that is a critical factor. But, you know, as Bloomington is exceptional, I think that they have responded in an exceptional way to the magazine. You know, I've done a lot of things in media in my life, but by far this is the most gratifying thing that I've ever done. The feedback from the readership has just been unbelievable. We get calls, letters, stopped on the street, in restaurants, people saying, just want to tell you how much we love the magazine. I get this all the time. It's like a love-in. I never get tired of it, and it's just so rewarding, I cannot tell you. And the business community has responded the same way. So I don't think this would work in a lot of places, especially I think that the magazine is of good quality and it is a legitimate magazine. It follows the directives of the American Society of Magazine Editors, of which I was a member in New York, so that there's a clear separation between editorial and advertising. You know, this is the last thing I'm going to do in my career. I want it to be as good as it can possibly be. You know, we use really first-rate paper, first-rate contributors, first-rate designers. It's a very expensive magazine to produce, shockingly expensive. There aren't very many communities where this would fly.
Now, where do you find all of these people to provide these services?
You know, as I was first going out to the advertisers, they would tell me, oh, there's this terrific photographer, there's this wonderful writer. And at the beginning, I wasn't contacting anybody, but I carry little notebooks and I took down every name that everybody told me. That's how I found you, Moya. You know, I contacted all of these people and met with all of them and saw samples of their work. But this is a constant search. I've probably had 200 or 300 people who have contacted me wanting to work for the magazine. So, you know, this is a never-ending process to try and get the very best writers, the very best photographers. And this is a hotbed of talent.
But do you use talent outside of this community as well for some of the production?
Yes, I do. The magazine was designed by a really top designer in New York City that I'd worked with many times over the years. I could never have afforded her if we hadn't been good personal friends. I also use, to a certain extent, two editors out of town. One, and both of these people have worked for me many times over the years. One of them is at Berkeley, and another one is in New York City. They're both top editors that have worked for, you know, some of the best newspapers and magazines in the country. I particularly needed this at the beginning, where although there are a lot of talented people in Bloomington, there isn't this heritage of magazines. So although the people were talented writers, they weren't necessarily magazine writers. So we needed more editing at the beginning. And as people are learning what we're doing, we need less and less.
Can you tell me a little bit about how writing for a magazine is different from any other kind of writing?
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, when you do something for such a long time, unlike academia, you're never sort of breaking it down. You know, you can be a little more subjective in your stories than you can in a newspaper, for example. Mm-hmm. A little more personal. There are things that I like. I like a story within the story. So, for example, in the very first issue of Bloom, we did an article on the farmers market. And Christine Barber, who is my food editor and wrote that story, she came up with the idea, rather than just doing a story on the farmer's market, to pick one of the farmers, a small farmer. We picked a woman and her three daughters who farm a small piece of land and bring their produce to local restaurants and to the farmer's market. So to me, the story, the big story is the farmer's market, but the more personal, more interesting story is the story of the small family. And I always think that people remember the anecdotes and the personal things in a story which really exemplify the story better than they may remember and appreciate the whole story. So I'm always looking for that, something that will really hopefully be memorable and keep you in the story.
Well, how do you find these topics all the time? How do you come up with topics? Do people suggest them or do you think of them? Or?
I get them every way. Certainly, again, when I was out with the advertisers, so many of them said, you should do a story on this, you should do a story on this, you should do a story on that. And, of course, once the magazine came out, I was just flooded with telephone calls and emails. Do a story about me. Do a story about my friend. Do a story about my daughter. Do a story about my neighbor. Do a story. And, you know, probably 10% of those are really good stories. And we did do stories, some of them, about my daughter and my neighbor. And so people – there's no shortage of people volunteering ideas. You know, now I probably use between 30 and 40 freelancers, photographers and writers and editors. They all come up with story ideas. And I get them daydreaming, walking down the street. You know, stories are everywhere. Really, the more difficult decision is deciding – what I want to have in the magazine and what kind of magazine I want it to be. And so even though some people suggest stories that are perfectly legitimate editorial stories, I don't feel they're right for the magazine and what I want the magazine to be.
And in each issue, I suppose you have to have a mix of various kinds of topics and various kinds of stories. So you're constantly being a big filter.
That's true. You know, there are many sort of different filters. You know, one of the strong points, I think, of the magazine, you know, that we can do that newspapers can't do and other places can't do is visually we can present things in a way that are special. And so in every issue, I want to make certain that I have something that can really be beautifully visually, that really gives the photographers an opportunity to stretch and do good things and for the readers to just see, you know, how beautiful this community is and the people in it and the outlying areas. So I'm always looking to make sure that I have one, at least one spectacularly beautiful story. You've probably noticed that in the feature, well, we don't do any ads. You know, I don't want anything. Each one to me is a hopefully a beautiful project, and I don't want any ads in the way of the design or taking the reader's mind off that story. But, you know, you filter it. You know, here I want it to be partly about the university and partly about the community. It's not a university publication, and it's not a publication for students. I'm sure many of them read it, but that's not my target audience. My target audience is the working and retired adult community of Bloomington. So, but I want it to be partly about the university, partly not about the university. I want to make sure that there's a mix of men and women. I want to be as inclusive as I possibly can to the various parts of this community. So, you know, all of these things are sort of juggling in my head, and then it comes out in the magazine, and I think, oh, my God, what did I do?
Well, so far you seem to have been doing wonderful things in every issue. But maybe this is a good time for me to ask you about what music you brought with you today. What's the first piece that you'd like to play?
Okay, the first piece is called Bird Alone, and it's sung by Abby Lincoln, and it's written by Abby Lincoln. And I don't know if you know anything about Abby Lincoln, but Abby Lincoln is a jazz singer. She's had many careers in the 50s, she was billed as the Black Marilyn Monroe, and I think at one point she even wore one of Marilyn Monroe's dresses at performing or in a movie. She was actually in what was probably the first rock and roll movie made by a major studio. It was called The Girl Can't Help It with Tom Ewell and Jane Mansfield, and she did a solo spot that was spectacular. She was billed as the next Billie Holiday. There was a lot of hype. She was pretty famous in the late 50s. And then during the civil rights movement, she became really outspoken and really an integral part of the civil rights movement as much as any entertainer. Then for a number of years, she just seemed to disappear, and I wasn't really that aware of her even. And then about 20 years ago, she just emerged again. Her voice was completely different now. It was a much more mature voice, and she had been writing songs, and they are wonderful songs. And I'm a groupie. I'm an Abby Lincoln groupie. I have seen her perform probably 30, 40 times. I've gone to different states to see her perform. I've been fortunate enough to talk to her a couple times. And she, I guess, is in her late 70s now. She's still performing. And this is a song that she wrote, one of her most famous songs called Bird Alone.
I'm Moya Andrews, and we're talking today with Malcolm Abrams, who is the editor and publisher of the new Bloom magazine. Well, Malcolm, tell us again the title of the composer.
And that was Abby Lincoln, and the title was Bird Alone.
And the composer was Abby Lincoln,
yes.
Also.
Yes.
So she writes her own songs.
Yes, she does.
And she's had some life-changing experiences and has metamorphosized into a writer. And you identify with someone who recreates themselves at various times of their life, I suppose.
Yeah, I do now. It was interesting. When I was picking out the music, I thought, I have something in common with her, I think.
And this you think, will be your last big career move?
This is my last. I mean, when I look back, I really see my life sort of in three stages. You know, I grew up and went into a profession of journalism and did some good things and not such good things. And I ended up working for Rupert Murdoch in New York and became a vice president of his business division and was the editorial director of about 20, 25 magazines. And probably just when my career was really thriving, I quit. And I decided it was not for me, you know, suits and being an executive wasn't for me. And I moved down to Greenwich Village, vowing never to have a job again. And I did a lot of different things. I wrote a couple books. I attempted to go into business. It didn't work. I became a magazine consultant, sort of redoing in troubled magazines. And it was a more kind of independent life. I often didn't shave for days and, didn't have to play dress up. And that was a different part of my life. And that lasted about 20 years until I was about 60. And here I am.
Well, that sounds like an interesting background. But let's go right back to the very beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Toronto.
Oh, you're Canadian.
Yes, I am.
And tell me what happened then. How long did you live in Canada? Where did you go to school?
I lived in Canada until I was 19. Although I was early on a good student, I hated high school, spent too many years there, never completed high school, went to Detroit, went to Wayne State University, studied journalism. I learned almost nothing there, but it got me a job working for a newspaper in Detroit. And so that's when I started. That's where I began. I actually have a tradition of newspapers. My grandfather was a newspaper man in New York and then later founded a weekly newspaper in Toronto. And my mother worked for the Toronto Star. She was a copy editor for the Toronto Star. So it's third generation.
It's in the genes. And then from Detroit, where did you go? Where was your next job?
Oh, from Detroit, I went to Israel for the Six-Day War, only I didn't know it was going to last 6 days, and I got there a few days late. So I spent some time in Israel. Then I went and lived in London, England. I really didn't know anybody or had anything to do there. I just wanted the experience of living in another country. So I lived there for a year, and I washed dishes and loaded trucks. And I ended up by opening and managing a bookstore on Charing Cross Road, which was a wonderful experience. At that time, it was still mainly bookstores, as it had been for centuries. Then I came back and briefly worked on a master's degree, but that didn't take. And so I started working for the Toronto Telegram. Then I worked for the Sudbury Star. And eventually, you know, I knew that if I wanted really to pursue journalism, I had to come to New York. I had the opportunity to work for Rupert Murdoch. I was the managing editor of The Star, that tabloid newspaper that sold in the supermarkets, which very much went against my grain, but I spent some time there. And then Rupert promoted me and put me in charge of these magazines that he had just paid $350 million for. I don't know whether he knew it or not, but I had never worked for a magazine. So it was on-the-job learning. And I moved down to the Village.
That set the course for you in terms of being interested primarily in magazines.
Yes.
What was it like working for Rupert Murdoch?
You know, when I look back on this, I think about it quite a bit because, you know, he's been in the news, of course, with the Wall Street Journal, but he's almost always in the news and there's always books coming out about him. I have mixed feelings because he treated me very well. And he was, on many levels, one of the nicest people I ever worked for. He was obviously incredibly smart and fast, but he was a lovely man, family man. I adored his wife, who was a novelist and really an impressive person in her own right. But you know, his politics really came to bother me to the point where I was not comfortable working there, and they weren't quite so apparent at the beginning. I'm at the opposite side of the political spectrum. So, on a personal level, I thought he was terrific. On a journalistic level now and a political level, I hate Fox News and what he's done to some of his publications.
You said you've worked for troubled magazines. Are you a rehabilitation specialist with magazines?
Yeah, I think I became that. I was a consultant to the National Audubon Society for many years. I worked on their magazines. I was a consultant to McGraw-Hill. I spent a long time redoing Architectural Record magazine. Really a wide variety of topics, American Birds magazine, Global Finance and International Finance magazine, a lot of business and travel magazines, a magazine called Spa Finder, which was a small magazine. It was actually a once-a-year directory, which I was hired to turn it into a magazine, which I did and spent a number of years working on it both as a consultant and then as the editor. I was interim editor of Audubon magazine, interim editor of Architectural magazine. I became a professional interim editor. So I worked for a lot of different areas, a lot of different subject matters, different kinds of magazines. I worked on everything from twice weekly publications to magazines that came out 4 times a year, 6 times a year, 12 times a year. And
so you were called in when someone needed to diagnose what was happening with a failing magazine?
Yes, not only diagnose it, but actually then come on board and make the changes that were necessary and reposition the magazine, have the magazine redesigned, really sort of recreate the magazine.
To be someone that does this kind of thing, you need a whole range of different kinds of skills. Tell me a little bit about how you think you acquired these skills.
I'm not sure I have these skills. I think, you know, the key to success is getting good people and having good people work for you. I'm not an expert in design. I'm not an expert in production. In fact, I'm just – production goes right through my head. So really the secret is finding good people to work for you, finding people who really do have that expertise. If there's any skill involved, I guess, it's really in picking the right people. And, you know, that's certainly been the case in Bloomington. You know, the magazine is only as good as the people who are contributing to it. And, You know, I have found world-class talent in Bloomington. And so if it is good, if it is a good magazine, it's because of the people who are contributing to it. I really see myself more as a facilitator. And so, you know, I think the other thing, too, is I don't have any expertise in anything. So I have a nice empty head. And, you know, I was able to learn enough about birds, learn enough about architecture, learn enough about a lot of different subjects that I could understand what needed to be done in the magazine.
Well, you seem as though you're very entrepreneurial. Have you always been like that, or is this something you've learned along the way?
No, I think I have been. I've had, you know, some failures in my life and some successes in my life. The failures, I don't think, have deterred me very much. I don't think I'm afraid of failing, which may or may not be a good thing. But, you know, I've had some real successes and some real failures. And but I think I am entrepreneurial.
And enthusiastic, I would suspect.
Yeah, if I decide to do something, I pretty much throw my whole being into it. And that was the case here.
And you lived so long in New York before you came here that one would suppose that two laid-back Midwesterners, you may seem a little assertive.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm sure there are a couple of people. I know there are a couple of people who feel that way about me. But, you know, I was also told that people would be very guarded here and they would be distrustful of an outsider. And very few people were like that. You know, people were very open and I didn't feel that people were not trusting me. And I don't think most people felt that I was pushy. I did live in New York for 30 years, but I'm from Toronto, which is a very polite, somewhat laid-back city. It's very similar to the Midwest. And I did live in the Midwest before.
So what do you think that you miss about living in a big city in Bloomington? Bloomington has all these wonderful things, but surely there are some things you miss about New York.
You know, very little. It's amazing. I miss some of my favorite restaurants and I miss some of my favorite people, but I talk to them a lot and email them a lot, and some of them have come to Bloomington to visit me. A lot of what I miss about New York isn't there anymore. A lot of the places that I loved aren't there anymore. My part of the village has changed drastically from a place of little jazz clubs and cute restaurants and really wonderful street life. It's become an upmarket shopping mall and a lot of sort of private discotheques, and it's changed so much that it didn't feel like my neighborhood anymore. So a lot of what I miss about New York isn't there anymore. A lot of the people I miss for one reason or another aren't there anymore either. So I don't really miss New York that much. And I love Bloomington and I love the pace of life here. I think the people are wonderful. It's just a tremendous community. And, you know, most people appreciate it. The letters to the editor that we get, everybody loves this town. I haven't met anybody here who said, I'm here because IBM transferred me here or Cook Pharmacia transferred me here or something. People are mostly here because this is where they want to be.
Well, you must have had to, though, work at first at setting up a new network. How did you do that?
It's just, you know, people referred me to people and they referred me to other people and people just kept referring me. And, you know, when I was living in that tenement at 10th and Lincoln, I couldn't meet people there. So I sort of set up my office at a table at the bakehouse downtown. And every half hour, I would have an appointment there meeting with people. And so it just kept expanding and expanding. And again,
so the bakehouse has been like your office.
To a certain extent,
from
yeah.
the beginning. Yeah. I know it's one of the places where one can pick up copies of Boom
yes.
magazine. And do you have subscriptions? Is it possible to get a subscription?
Yes, there's a subscription card in the magazine. We also have a good website called magbloom.com. You can subscribe online. This has been one of the really surprising things because I wasn't going to offer subscriptions at the beginning because I didn't figure if it's a free magazine, who's going to pay for it? And but people said, well, you know, there's a lot of people come from out of town, alumni and people who come for sporting events, and they might like to keep up what's happening in Bloomington. So we put the card in. I'm not exactly sure where we are now, but I know we're over 500 subscriptions, and we have subscribers in 31 states. The majority, probably 80% of the subscribers, are from Bloomington. And it's wonderful because they all write little notes. We love the magazine. We love this. We love that. We just want to support you. So a lot of people subscribe because they want to contribute to supporting the magazine. It seems like people are very worried it's going to go away, that they can't believe that giving away this magazine can possibly, you know, that it can possibly be sustained. And so they want to contribute. And then because the magazine disappears so fast, the last magazine, the June-July issue, after about 10 days, the phone was already ringing off. Though, where can I get an issue? Where can I get an issue? The places were out. So they want to make sure they get one.
And how many do you print?
We print 13,000.
Are you going to increase that number?
You know, that's a tricky situation because to increase it, I would have to increase the cost of the advertising. And I'm afraid of pricing out a lot of the smaller advertisers, boutiques, restaurants. I do feel that many of those are the heart and soul of the magazine. But I will be increasing it. I have to because I think I could probably put out another 5,000 or 6,000 magazines and they would go. But 13,000 was the right number because when I was looking at those 75 other city and regional magazines, I was looking at the populations, the distribution. This was a healthy number for a community of this size.
So you projected the right number.
It was the right number, but not for Bloomington because this is a more literate, enthusiastic community, and they want more than 13,000.
Now, has the university used the magazine to recruit faculty and students?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I got a beautiful email the other day from Daniel Smith, the dean of the Kelly School of Business, about how they're using it all over the world to recruit students. The dean of faculties just ordered, I think, 150 issues. The music school, the journalism school, the drama department, the law school, they're using it to recruit graduate students. So the university is using the magazine a lot.
So the university buys those copies in order
Sometimes. We're starting to charge them because we've been sending over hundreds and hundreds of issues. So we've just started to charge them recently.
I see.
But if they advertise, they get them for free.
Oh, so advertisers get as many as they
need? Well, within reason. Within reason.
I see. So there are all kinds of ways in which a magazine like this can be used. Is it in the hotel so that convention goers, for example, would pick one up when they first check in?
Yeah, it's in the better hotels. It's in the rooms so that we give them several copies because people take it and they can put a new one in the room. But it's in the major hotels and inns and B&Bs.
Would you describe yourself as having a nose for news?
I think I have a sense of what's newsworthy and what's worth a story. I've been doing this most of my life. I do think I do.
Now, who is your major competitor here in Bloomington?
Well, I guess that would be there's this thing that HT puts out called Homes and Lifestyles of South Central Indiana, and that existed here. I didn't know about it when I came here because I talked to people and people didn't know about it. It's mailed to upmarket residents.
And do you have a larger circulation than that, or don't you know?
Well, they're saying now that they have 13,000 circulation. When we came here, they had 11. I think they upped it to the same number that we have.
Now, what's your philosophy as a publisher and an editor? Do you have a particular philosophy that about what you think is appropriate to do with a magazine, or do you have any sort of guidelines you follow?
Yeah, I do. In some ways, it's a very old-fashioned philosophy. You know, some magazines, they're really published for the advertiser. You know, that what's in it is really meant to appeal to the advertiser. So if you advertise, you get a nice puff piece that you can put up on the wall, or maybe they let you write stories if you advertise. I don't do that. I try to keep a real separation between editorial and advertising. Advertisers aren't allowed to write for the magazine. Only professional writers write for the magazine. There's no quid pro quo at all, and every advertiser has been told that when they purchase the advertising or before they purchase the advertising, that what they're getting for their money is the ad. They're not getting a story about their business. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't do one. If it's newsworthy, we'll do it. If we don't think it's newsworthy, we won't. So this is very important to me. The magazine that I do is for the reader. I don't think about how it's going to please other people, whether those other people are the advertisers or the university or whatever powers there are. I do it for the reader, what I think will be interesting for the people who live in Bloomington.
So you are the one that makes those decisions.
Yes.
You don't have an editorial board.
No.
No, this is pretty much your decision. And what do you think that will happen to this magazine? Is it going to last? I mean, is it going to last as long as you are there with the enthusiasm and the driving force? Or do you see that other people will start to take more and more of a role?
You know, when I came here, I thought, God willing, I'd like to do this for 10 years. I came here when I was 60. I'd like to do it till I'm 70. Maybe I'd like to do it beyond that. You know, that is my plan. But I would like it to be continued, or should I decide not to do it for 10 years, which is why I've started to bring on other editorial people, also in case I got sick or whatever, that the magazine could continue. So I definitely do not want it to be just me putting out a magazine anymore. You know, the questions I get asked the most time about the magazine are, people seem always so concerned about its viability. Because I think that most people in the business did not believe that this was possible to do this magazine in this community. So they're very concerned about, are you making any money? Are you going to be able to keep doing this? And
are you making any money?
Yeah. You know, in the first year, I've recovered all of the initial investment of the magazine. I'm definitely making a living doing this magazine. It's been coming. I've worked out of a home office. We are taking business offices. The people who will be there part-time or full-time, that's going to be expanding. So when I did my four-year plan for the magazine, we are ahead of where I thought we would be at the end of 4 years. So it has been far better and far faster than I ever anticipated. Number two, we will never charge for the magazine. It's a free magazine. I get asked that all the time. Some people suspected that this was a come-on, that it was free, and then we would start charging. I'm not going to start a magazine in West Lafayette or in any other community in Indiana or any place else. This is my last stop. I love Bloomington. I feel very fortunate to be living here and to be doing something that I love. So those are the questions that I get asked all the time, and those are the answers.
Well, it sounds like this has been a wonderful year. This is the anniversary, the first anniversary,
yes,
of the magazine. And it's been a momentous year for you personally. I know that during this last year that you were married to Jenny. And I think there's a special song you both have that you brought along to play for us today.
Yeah, it's called Dance Me to the End of Love. It's written and sung by Leonard Cohen. I took dance lessons at Arthur Murray to this song over and over again to be able to do the rumba. And Craig Brenner and the Crawdaddies performed at our wedding, and they learned this. So
it has lots of memories.
It has lots of meanings. Yes.
Good. Let's listen to it then.
Safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my homeward dove. Dance me to the end of.
I'm Moya Andrews, and we're talking today with Malcolm Abrams, who is the editor and publisher of the new Bloom magazine, which has just completed its first year of publication in our community. Malcolm, as you look back over Bloom's first year, I imagine you have a few thoughts about lessons learned.
Are you suggesting that I've made some mistakes, Moya?
I would never suggest that, Malcolm. But how would you have done anything differently? Or wouldn't you? Maybe it's been such a resounding success.
Do you know,
there's nothing you would have done differently.
God, if I say I haven't made any mistakes, I'll sound like President Bush. I guess I have. I don't think I've done anything major wrong. I'm sure I've done some small things wrong. I'm sure, in fact, I know I've done a lot of small things wrong. I've been very, very lucky. I worked very hard. I think for the first 8 months I was here before the first issue came out, I pretty much worked 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was pretty intense. And I've had a lot of luck. I ran into a lot of the right people. Some of the hiring decisions I made weren't my first choice. I couldn't get my first or second or third choice, and my fourth choice turned out to be better. I was really fortunate that some of the really talented people in this town, like Angelo Pizzo and Scott Russell Sanders and Christine Barber and Steve Raymer and Jeff Wolin and yourself and Leanne Sandweiss, Michael Carita, just what a talent pool. Patrick Bode, that these people took a chance on the magazine and came on. So I don't really have regrets or think that I made any major mistakes. I'm actually amazed that most of the decisions that I made turned out right. That's not my track record all the time.
Do you still have only two half-time people?
Yeah, I have two part-time people, and one of those is relatively new. So I had somebody helping me on the business and advertising side. Now I have somebody helping me on the editorial side. In September, I'm going to start taking on interns, and I'll be taking a couple of high school interns and I'm sure at least one from the university. I've wanted to do this, but I haven't had the space to do this. And I imagine that, you know, I'm taking office space finally. That's why I'm going to have room. I think that we'll be expanding and that there'll be at some point we'll actually have a full-time employee or two.
Great. What's the business plan at this point in terms of expansion? Are you going to expand so that you have, for example, any other contiguous magazines?
You know, it is possible at some point, but that's certainly not anything in the immediate future that I'm thinking about.
But, you know, it's harder to sustain some things than it is to get them going. Does this worry you?
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. But one of the things that I've always loved about journalism is that it never gets boring. You know, you're always working on different stories. You're always learning things. When I pick the stories, they're not always stories that I'm interested in, but they're stories that I believe a lot of other people will be interested in. So I learn about things that I wouldn't ordinarily be attracted to.
So that keeps you going.
Yeah, that absolutely keeps me going. It's every issue is a bunch of projects, and I learn a lot from those, and it keeps me stimulated and interested and excited. I love the business. I particularly love seeing the words and the pictures and the design come together. That's so rewarding. And then every time an issue comes out, it's your birthday. You know, when that issue arrives and you hold it in your hands and you see it distributed. And unlike national publications, you know, I can go to a restaurant or a coffee place and see 10, 20 people sitting there going through the magazine, and that's a fabulous feeling.
Very reinforcing, I'm sure. Now, tell me, do you have a favorite story? I know that your dog, Sophie, was in the story about the dogs in Bryan Park. Mm-hmm. Does this make that one of your special favorites?
There's a lot of stories that I've liked. I love the story that Christine Barber did on the farmer's market. I like the story that we did on Bloomington poets. I like the story that we did on Bloomington singer-songwriters. I love the 20 questions that we did with Bill Cook and with Bob Hamill and Angelo Pizzo. I love Q&A stories because I think that even though they run very long, I think you get a much better sense of the person than you often get in just feature stories. Most of the stories I like, there are a couple I've been disappointed in, but most of them I've been pretty happy with.
Now, do you have the kind of personality that needs new challenges and projects? And does looking for new stories satisfy that need in you?
Yeah, it does satisfy it. It really does. I think there'll be other things that I might get into here. We did that photograph in the park. We did with the city where we invited all the dogs in town to come to Bryant Park and have their picture taken by Steve Raymer, the former National Geographic photographer. We ran the picture. People paid $5, and that went to support the City of Bloomington Animal Shelter. And it was such a beautiful day and so much fun. So I can see doing events like that. I have a number of ideas. I'd like them all to be a little different than things that are going on now, maybe just a little edgy.
And things, too, that benefit the community in a variety of
Absolutely.
Ways.
I mean, this is part of the whole thing for me. This is a huge part. When I talked about why I wanted to come to Bloomington, I guess I neglected to say I love the sense of community, and I saw that in the first 4 days that I was here. This is something that's really difficult in New York, where you have a metropolitan population of 17 million. It's really hard to change things or affect things or even to make a significant contribution. And here it's so easy. There's so much going on here. So there's so much you can get involved in. And hopefully the magazine is having a positive impact on the community. And that's a big part of what I enjoy about being here.
Well, maybe we have time for some more music. What's the next selection you've got for us?
It's called One Too Many Christmases, and I wouldn't say that this is a lifelong favorite of mine, but, you know, I sort of picked it because to represent all of the amazing talent that's in Bloomington. You know, we did a story on singer-songwriters, and we profiled six of them, and this song is by Krista Detour, who I absolutely adore her music. I think she's an incredibly talented songwriter, and I think that this song, which is perhaps an anti-Christmas song. It's sort of a hit the road, Jack, but with a lot better lyrics. And this is not only for Krista, it's for Carrie Newcomer and Tom Rosnowski and Tim Grimm, these just amazing talents that are here in Bloomington. At Christmas time, I took this record around, this CD around everywhere that I went to every party and made people play it so that I was just so knocked out by it.
On the clock up on the wall, there are one too many minutes waiting for someone to call, and I have one too many Christmases with nothing much at all, and I have you, but we are through. There are one too many TV shows that start and end with cars, there are one too many telephones at one too many bars, and I have one too many photographs and things you said were ours, and I have you. We are through, so take your one too many I love yous and your one too many honeydews and your favorite Christmas poster of the girls who sell the beer. Take your light up Rudolph reindeer nose and your Dukes of Hazzard videos and take your Yuletide ass right out of here.
Malcolm, you seem to be one of these people who are putting down roots in Bloomington. It's something that happens commonly. And as a gardener, I like to see it. But tell me, how do you see these stages that have taken place and how the roots have started to go into the ground here in this community in this last year for you?
Well, I've actually been here now about 21 months because it took me 9 months to get the first magazine out. So I've been here more than a year. Actually, it's almost 2 years now. And, I bought a house over a year ago. I was really fortunate to find a lovely old house on First Street.
I'm surrounded by students, which is fine with me. I found them to be good neighbors. And, you know, I got Sophie, my dog from the pound, early on, and she's turned out to be a delight. And then I was really fortunate to meet a wonderful woman and be married here. So I guess that's about as much roots as you can put down.
That is. That's pretty good going in 2 years. Your personality is one, I think, to move full steam ahead. And you always seem to be in high gear. Tell me about how you balance your personal and professional lives and how you relax.
I'm not a great relaxer. I'm hoping to be able to take a vacation every 2 or 3 months. And we went to Venice recently for our honeymoon, and we were in Florida. And I love traveling. And probably the whole time I was in New York for business or pleasure, I probably took one trip about every 6 weeks. So the actual time that I was here for the first 8 months where I didn't go anywhere, I was getting a little antsy. So I love to travel. And I love sports, and I love theater, and I love music. And Bloomington has a lot of those things. And it's got a beautiful countryside, and I like to get out in the country. And I live near Bryant Park, which is lovely. So, you know, if I can relax, those are the ways that I relax.
Well, that sounds like a plan. Tell me about your managerial style, and also, how would you describe your personality?
Oh, these are really tough questions, Moya. I'm not sure I have a managerial style, but
you're a lone ranger. Maybe you're a lone ranger.
Well, I have managed a lot of staffs, and I think at the beginning I was not very good at it. I think that, you know, you learn lessons as you go along, and by the time that I finished my career in New York, I think I was a pretty good manager. I try to be really straight with people. I try to give them as much information as they can so that they can feel a part of what of the bigger picture. I've always been better managing people down than dealing with people up, with owners, because I think I am pretty independent.
Well, fortunately, you don't have anyone up anymore.
And that is such a pleasure. You know, I think a lot of managing is just being honest and being mature. And I think, you know, maturity, there's very few shortcuts to maturity. So I think it's taken me some time. It took me some time to get to the point. I don't think until I was in my mid-40s, even though I had managed, you know, hundreds of people, I don't think I was really any good at it until I was about in my mid-40s.
So we're lucky because we got you when you know a lot of things.
Well, that's a little dangerous to think you know a lot of things because you can get some real surprises. But I certainly know more than I used to.
And, of course, at this stage in your career, you have had experience with launching and working with so many different types of magazines that it's not surprising that you've done a superb job.
But again, you know, part of the key to being a good manager is hiring good people.
And retaining them. You have lived in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And you have told us about how much you like living in Bloomington. But if you could change one thing, what would it be?
I don't think there's any huge things. I really get sick of hearing people complain about the parking downtown. I wish that the downtown were a little livelier, to be quite honest. I think anything that can be done to encourage people to come downtown, particularly at night, you know, I've written about this in the editor's message. To me, this is so important to have a vital downtown. There is nothing more depressing than going to a city or a town where the downtown is either all chain stores or it's depressed. And, you know, I think they've done a good job at the downtown here. I would like to see it even livelier than it is.
Well, we've got one more music selection which talks about New York, which is probably a place that is livelier than Bloomington. The selection is Autumn in New York by Billie Holiday. Can you talk a little bit about why this is a selection you've enjoyed?
Well, I love Billie Holiday. I think this is one of the most beautiful songs and the most beautiful rendition. It is my favorite season in New York, and my wife Jenny hasn't been to New York yet, so we're planning on going in the autumn. It's just a beautiful song. When the Ken Burns jazz series was on, I remember one of the commentators saying that he told his wife, this is what he wants played at his funeral, Autumn in New York by Billie Holiday, and I thought,
I might ask the same thing.
So that resonates with you.
Yes.
We have been talking today with the editor and the publisher of Boom Magazine, our new and exciting magazine in Bloomington. Our guest was Malcolm Abrams, and thank you, Malcolm, for spending time with us today and for sharing your thoughts with our WFIU audience. I'm Moya Andrews, and thanks for listening.
Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York. It spells the thrill of first nighting. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds and canyons of steel. They're making me feel I'm home. It's autumn in New York.
The program you just heard was recorded in August of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.